Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk about taxes. Imagine that. Is it April yet? No. Is it March 15th yet? No. Almost. All right. Those are different due dates. Anyway, we got Tom O'Rourke, the dean of Getting Me on the Radio. How long ago was it?
I was just talking to Andrew when I came in, and I said it's been at least 20 years ago.
Oh, I think it might be longer than that. Yeah.
Probably late 80s sometime, yeah. Bob.
And Tom did a show right around when Mike Causey had his show, and what was it called? Federal Forum?
I don't remember.
Yeah, something like that. Anyway, enough of the history. Tom is a tax attorney with Miles and Stockbridge, and I do believe you're a partner.
Yes.
And it's great to have you here, and we're going to talk about taxes. Now, we might go into your side of the world of taxes. I live on the 1040 small business side, and you do this estate planning and state exemptions and whatnot. So why don't we hit with that first? There was an increased estate tax exemption, not state estate, but estate at the federal level, and maybe some at the state level. So what is an estate tax to begin with?
Well, an estate tax is a tax which is levied on the value of your assets as of the date of your death. You take a snapshot of what you have on the day you die, and your executor, your personal representative, or whoever steps in to administer your estate is obligated to file an estate tax return if the value of your assets exceeds a certain level.
But Tom, isn't that double tax? They taxed during my life. I saved, I did this, I did that, I did what I'm supposed to do, and then when I pass, of course, I'm not overly concerned about the taxes that are going to be paid, but I am because it would go to my heirs, whoever they might be, and they get less.
That's right.
Is that the way it works?
That's exactly the way it works. And you've obviously never heard of the hand of taxes. First, they tax you when you earn it. Secondly, they tax you when you spend it. That's a sales tax. Third, if you buy a piece of real estate, they tax you while you hold it. That's called a property tax. Fourth, they tax you when you give it away. That's called a gift tax. And finally, they tax you when you die. That's an estate tax. However, Bob, the estate tax is really pretty easy to avoid. The reason for that is the exemption now at the federal level is $5,340,000. So for all of your listeners out there who have somehow managed to keep the level of their assets below $5,340,000, they've done a great job of estate tax planning.
Okay, now that's at the federal level, and
that's
it's pretty high
level
once you cross that. But as I understand it, state estate tax,
that's true,
isn't necessarily so low, so high. Maybe it's not there at all.
Well, all of what you said is true, depending on where you live. Some states do have state estate taxes. Approximately 20 of the 50 states have state estate taxes. In the area where we live, in the metropolitan D.C. area, two out of the three local jurisdictions have state estate taxes, and they're pretty similar. The first $1 million in assets is exempt in either Maryland or D.C., and anything above that can be taxed at a rate as high as 16%. Virginia does not have a state estate tax. It's the bad news for folks who live in Metro D.C. Now, I'm sure there are a lot of folks out there thinking, doesn't this guy understand he's talking to federal employees? We aren't rich. Well, what I typically find is for estate tax purposes, people are a lot richer than they may think because it includes a lot of things that are not available to you to spend right now. One very typical example being life insurance. Your life insurance isn't worth anything while you're alive. But if you die, the full value of that policy could be taxed in your estate. That's the bad news. The good news is both the Speaker of the Maryland House of Delegates and the Senate Majority Leader have proposed to make the Maryland estate tax law consistent with the federal level. Unfortunately, the governor apparently is opposed to that, and it's being considered in the current session of the Maryland legislature, and what will happen is really anybody's guess.
I think I don't claim to be a politically understanding individual, but it's my understanding here, some of the sensitivity to Maryland saying, listen, we'll join the feds, is that people will move out of Maryland. Maryland's a high-income state, and therefore they collect some estate tax on those that have assets of more than, like you say, $1 million, and that's an awful lot of money. But when you talk about life insurance and value homes and things like that, maybe it isn't as much as we thought it was. So if they were then to do that, maybe they would stem the flow of the refugees moving from Maryland to Virginia or parts unknown. Do you think that's the motivating force behind it, or is it just to make it simple?
I don't think it's just to make it simple. My experience is limited. I obviously deal with a limited number of people, but I deal with a lot of people who live in Maryland and tell me, if I've got to give a big chunk of my assets, and if you have an estate tax liability, it can easily be a six-figure number. For example, if you have an estate of $2 million, now $2 million is a lot of money, but your estate tax is $100,000, and that's $100,000 you could give to your kids. And I have a lot of clients tell me that I am moving out of Maryland to avoid that. Now, and I've had many clients who've already done it. But on the other side of that is many people say that's not a factor. And in my experience, it is a factor. People are leaving Maryland because of that. The extent of that, I really don't know.
Okay, in the inside the Beltway, I think we have a feel for it, but we do have listeners outside the Beltway,
sure.
Or we have listeners inside the Beltway that would otherwise move out. Oftentimes, a move is not based on, but in consideration of the state income tax when they retire. Not to say that that should be the primary focus, but if somebody was to go to a tax-favored state, a state that doesn't have a state income tax or a very low one, would they meet with a potentially higher – we can't do every state in the country, but is there a potential that there would be a lower exemption for estate tax, and then the estate tax makes up for the low income tax?
Most of the states that do not have an income tax also don't have an estate tax. There are only, I believe, two or three states that have a lower exemption than $1 million, and one of those is New Jersey. New Jersey, I believe the exemption is $675,000, and I believe the other state that has an exemption level below $1 million is Rhode Island. Many states, or not, I shouldn't say many, there are some states that have an inheritance tax. It's a little bit different. The estate tax taxes the entity, the estate that's created after a person dies. An inheritance tax taxes the people who receive those assets. For example, the only local state, the only state around the Beltway that has an inheritance tax is Maryland. And the Maryland inheritance tax is really pretty simple. It's 10% of the value of any assets that are inherited unless the deceased individual was a member of your family. If you leave assets to your spouse, your children, your parents, your grandparents, your grandchildren, or your siblings, it's totally exempt regardless of how much it is. If you leave it to anybody else, a good friend, a favorite niece or nephew, it's taxed at a flat 10% rate. And that tax applies regardless of where the recipient of the inheritance lives. It depends on where the deceased individual lived. And I know Maryland has an inheritance tax. In fact, I think Maryland's the only state in the union that has both an estate tax and an inheritance tax. Pennsylvania does not have an estate tax, but it does have a pretty stiff inheritance tax.
Okay. So, one of the assets that our listeners would have certainly would be their thrift. Now, the FERS individual most likely has a higher balance than what the CSRSer does, given the same years in service. And that is a potential powder keg. Now, I'm ignoring the fact whether the individuals are married or whether they're single. They have a thrift. Add that thrift balance to whatever other assets they might have, equity in a home, maybe some other accumulations of money, IRAs, or the like. Now, when that individual passes, let's say that they're not married. Let's just say that they're single.
Mm-hmm.
There might be an issue there, correct?
Because there's certainly an issue because many times the thrift, as you correctly point out, is part of their gross estate. It is something that's subject to inheritance tax, or excuse me, estate tax. But it also is subject to income tax. Remember, the money in the thrift, unless you've opted for the Roth TSP, which is relatively new, everything in there has never been subject to tax. So when it comes out, whether it's you or your beneficiaries take it out, it's subject to income tax. So what people sometimes do, the thrift is also highly liquid. You can liquidate your interest in the thrift very quickly. Sometimes what people do say, oh, I'll take the money out of the thrift to pay the estate tax. And when they do that, not only do they have to pay estate tax, they also have to pay income tax. And there were some horrible examples. You remember, I don't recall exactly when it was. It used to be that unless your any tax-deferred accounts, such as the thrift, went to your spouse, he or she had to take the money out and pay taxes on it immediately. And there were some horrible situations that I dealt with where somebody worked a whole career, had all their money tied up in a tax-deferred account. When they died, they had an estate tax liability. The only liquid assets they had were in their tax-deferred account. They took the money out. Between the estate tax and the income tax, they could end up losing 80% of what they had in the account. It's pretty hard for that to happen now unless somebody is just totally oblivious to the tax consequences of inheriting something from the thrift or other tax-deferred account.
I had an occasion, I would say it was fortunate and unfortunate for this reason. Individuals of Fed had a substantial amount of money in the thrift. They unfortunately passed. They were married. The spouse was a non-Fed, and the spouse inherited the money. Unfortunately, the spouse passed away very shortly after the first spouse.
Mm-hmm.
The only people left were the children. They have to pay tax on the full amount. Ouch.
Yeah.
So the question here is the thrift bad? No. The tax law, just to be aware of it, had the surviving spouse elected to put the money in an IRA, and then the kids went and inherit the IRA, I believe the tax treatment is totally different.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. And one of the things, and the rules regarding the taxation of money in tax-deferred accounts can be mind-boggling. I frequently sit down with people that spend their whole life working on tax issues, and you argue all the time about the best way to pull money out of a tax-deferred account. It's extremely complex. The one thing I always tell my clients is tell your children or tell whoever your beneficiaries are before they start pulling money out of tax-deferred accounts to sit down with a knowledgeable tax advisor because there are ways to minimize tax liability, but if you don't observe the proper steps to take that money, you can end up losing a significant portion of it to taxes that otherwise could have either been avoided or minimized.
You're very clever, Tom. You mixed the estate tax and then brought in the income tax to say, hey, it isn't just one, it's two. And be aware, even while the person is alive, when they take money out of these tax-deferred vehicles, it goes on top of all their other money as far as taxation goes. So it's not necessarily taxed, and it isn't taxed at a low rate. It's taxed at the individual's highest rate.
Right.
We got tax and estate planning issues, but we have a new, I guess, opportunity for planning with same-sex marriages. Now, with the law with regards to same-sex marriages, pretty much the same as if it wasn't a same sex? I mean, do they join the same club? Is it somebody that, quote, married, end quote, and doesn't make any difference?
At the federal level, it doesn't make any difference whether your spouse is the same sex or the opposite sex. But I think this is the first year where that's been true. I believe last year was the year the Windsor case, the Supreme Court case, was decided, in which the Supreme Court said same-sex marriages for many purposes, including tax purposes, are to be treated the same as any other marriage. And what some same-sex couples are finding out is they need to take another look at whatever planning they've done. For example, something we used to talk about fairly regularly was the marriage penalty, a situation where if two individuals who made approximately the same amount of money were married to one another, they would pay more tax if they were married than if they were two single individuals. Well, that applies to same-sex couples, but this is the first time this current year, the tax return for 2013, is the first time they've confronted that issue. On the other hand, there's also some good news, which is what the Windsor case was all about for same-sex couples. The easiest way to avoid the estate tax, regardless of how much money you have, if you're married, just leave it to your spouse, because assets that pass to a surviving spouse are fully deductible. So if Bill Gates, for example, richest man in the world, were to die and leave everything to his wife, his estate tax liability would be zero because he gets an unlimited deduction. That now applies as a result of the Windsor case, also applies to same-sex couples. But for same-sex couples who are for the first time looking at their tax situation, they may have a surprise. It may be pleasant. It may not be pleasant.
Could I ask you a question?
Let's
say this couple comes into you and you're talking and you tell them about this unanticipated tax problem that they have. Again, given roughly the same earnings, the two now married, the joint tax would be greater than the sum of the two single taxes. So they go, Tom, well, that's easy. We'll just file single. And what advice would you have?
Well, I'd say don't do that because under the tax code, you look at your marital status as of the last day of the year. And for virtually everybody, that's December 31st for all individuals. So you're either married or you're not married on the last day of the year. And if you were married, you don't have the option of filing as a single individual. Your only option is to either file as a married person filing jointly or as a married person filing separately. And generally, the tax rates are such that it rarely makes sense for married couples to file as separately. There are circumstances where it could make sense, but in most cases it doesn't. And the one thing I always tell people is have their CPA or whoever's preparing their tax return to do it both ways. Figure out which is going to cost you more, married filing separately or married filing jointly. And I think in virtually all cases, you're going to come out paying less in tax if you file a joint return.
Right. And with our program that we use at work, and I'm certain that TurboTax does, or other computer-aided software products, and with a few clicks of a mouse, assuming we coded the different income and deductions, you know, taxpayer spouse, I can tell without doing it, which is the better way to go, a joint return or two separate returns. And like you say, way more often than not, it's a joint return because not that many people have roughly the same income. There's a disparity one way or the other. And then the question is, if you have to file separate returns because it gives you lower tax, it's a nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the one circumstance where I always tell people, married couples, to file separately is if you believe your spouse may be hiding income.
Met one of those.
You didn't. Well, take it. There are situations where that does happen, where people do not accurately report all of their income. And if you're in a marriage where you believe your spouse is not accurately reporting his or her income, it's advisable to file separately. Because if your name is on that joint return, and if there's a mistake, you're jointly and severally liable, which means that if your spouse was hiding income, you can be held liable for the tax on that income, even though you never saw it. Now, there is a concept in the law called innocent spouse, but it's hard to prove you're entitled to that.
Yeah, I would say if they're hiding income but enjoying the benefits of the hidden income, one couldn't say, gee, I didn't know where that big house and car came from.
Well, which is usually the reason people don't qualify for innocent spouse relief. I will never forget a case that I had one time when I worked in the Internal Revenue Service.
You worked there?
I did. I spent about 10 years at IRS.
Wow.
And while I was there, we had the case of a gentleman who, when we looked at his tax return, he listed his occupation as a short order cook, and he listed his income as $6,000 for the preceding tax year. And IRS was very curious how on $6,000 of income he was able to buy a house and a new Mercedes and pay cash for both. It appeared that the gentleman had another source of income. He was engaged in the sale of illegal narcotics, and he didn't report that income. So there are ways for the IRS to determine if somebody does have hidden income. And in that case, he had a spouse, and she said, I didn't know anything about this. And they said, yeah, but how did you manage to live in the seven-bedroom house? And didn't you think maybe driving that Mercedes was kind of unusual for somebody who was a short-order cook? And she was found civilly liable. He went to jail. He was criminally prosecuted, but she ended up on the hook for a big liability.
Wow. So, well, and interesting you talk about that. Most folks listening, I would say all the folks listening, aren't going to be in that situation.
But
you love hearing the stories. I hear stories. Actually, I was aware of this one, and people were spending a lot of money in Vegas. And those eyes in the sky, I believe, are not only there for the casino, but they're there for IRS. And they tracked it back through to this these people in Maryland, and they weren't reporting all their income. So something like that. How would you figure?
Yeah.
Anyway, we're way out there with that. Now, changes in the law governing powers of attorney. What is a power of attorney? Is that because you're powerful?
That's because you're powerful. No, it's because a power of attorney is a document where one person gives another person the authority to act on their behalf. I give you the authority to go to closing and sign my name, promising that I will repay a loan. And a power of attorney, powers of attorney are used all the time in estate planning. And the main reason they are used is to protect you in the event of your incapacity. What happens if you reach a point in your life where you no longer have the ability to manage your finances? Maybe you develop Alzheimer's disease. Maybe your vision is poor and you simply want one of your children to step in and take over paying your bills. A power of attorney is a document by which you can give an agent, somebody of your choosing, the authority to step in the event you lose the ability to manage your affairs. And powers of attorney are used all the time in estate planning. As people tend to live longer, it becomes more and more common that they may reach a point in their lives where they no longer have the ability to manage their own affairs. And so powers of attorney, I know in my practice, I tell individuals, for most of you, it's probably more important that you have a power of attorney than having a will. And that's simply because the likelihood that anybody will become incapacitated in any given year is probably more likely than that they will die. And it literally can happen to anybody. You can become incapacitated whether you're rich or whether you're poor. And if you don't have a power of attorney, the only way that somebody can get the authority to act on your behalf is to go to court and seek to be appointed your guardian. Now, I've been a lawyer for over 30 years now, and the one thing I've learned better than any, the worst way in the world to solve a problem is to get a court involved to help you do it. You never want courts involved in managing your day-to-day affairs. So a power of attorney is a way, that's a very long-winded answer to a very simple question. A power of attorney is simply a tool that you can use to give somebody else the authority to act on your behalf.
Is there a general power of attorney that if I granted somebody, they could handle the estate, they could handle this function, that function, or do I need to be more focused to, it'd be a power of attorney, like you say, to go to settlement for me for this one property?
It can be either one. Many times powers of attorney used in the estate planning context are general powers of attorney. I give you the authority to do anything that I could do. In many contexts, powers of attorney are limited. Personal example, I was traveling. My wife and I were refinancing our home. I couldn't go to closing on the day I was going to be out of town. And the bank said, we're not going to give you the money to refinance a loan unless you sign a note promising to repay. So I couldn't be there. I gave a power of attorney to my wife. That's a limited power of attorney, an authorization to do a very specific act. Something you and I deal with all the time on behalf of clients is clients will execute a power of attorney authorizing the Internal Revenue Service to talk to us as an agent for an individual. But in the estate planning context, typically powers of attorney are general powers of attorney.
Good point. I am named power of attorney fairly frequently, but with regards to the IRS, not
right.
necessarily the legal side. And somebody will get a notice, and we'll talk about these notices in a minute, and they go, what is this? And I go, well, I can respond to it more often than not. They're not accurate, throwing no dispersions at the IRS, but it's just, you know, they use computer-generated forms, and it just goes out. I understand them, and I said, here, just sign this. It's only granting me the opportunity to respond to the letter and show potentially where it's inaccurate. And it's just an IRS form. It, you know, I don't have to go to an attorney to have it done. Now I've seen more often than not, if it's a couple, each has to sign a separate one. For years, it was joint, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So if we could go with that, I just know some of the listeners have had one of these notices in the last few years because they've become a whole lot more frequent than they ever were before, and I think it's because the IRS's computers are getting better and better, and they take data that, say, a dividend or an interest amount was paid from XYZ company or ABC bank, and it goes to the IRS, and, of course, it goes to the taxpayer. And it might be an IRA distribution, goes to the IRS, and W-2, same thing. And it's called a matching program. And affectionately, the notice that comes is called a CP-2000. I don't know what CP-2000 stands for, but if you look in the upper right-hand corner, if you get one of these notices, that's what it is. It's really matching what the IRS has in its computer to what was on the tax return. And certainly, they're only going to send it if they have more income in the computer than what they do on the I've never seen one work in the reverse, and
right.
I don't think I ever will.
They don't tell you reported too much income.
Right. And it unnerves the taxpayer. I mean, it's fairly official-looking form. Sometimes it's 10 pages, most of which is just kind of like, meh. I'm being audited. They are auditing me. And I go, no, they're not. We got a hiccup here with regards to what's in the IRS's computer. And it's fairly easy to respond to. And they just sign the one page, and they allow me to. And I said, okay, here's da-da, and here's where we reported it, or here's why we didn't report it, because it's non-taxable. Or there could be something wrong. I had one the last year. It was an IRA transfer, and it was $75,000. And the two ends didn't connect. And the client never got it, but it was sent in, and it was wrong to begin with. So we had to go back to the IRA custodian and say, well, what are you doing here? It didn't cost the taxpayer a penny in tax. It cost them a lot of weight and worry.
Many times when those and that's a really good example. Anytime people transfer money from one tax deferred account to another, everybody says, well, it's a tax-free rollover, which it is. If you take money out of one tax-deferred account and put it into another one, it is tax-free. You don't have to pay taxes on it. But the account from which it was distributed will issue a form showing that you received a $75,000 distribution. And unless IRS has another piece of paper to match up showing that you did transfer that into another IRA account, they're going to assume you had $75,000 in income that you didn't report, and they're going to send you one of these notices you talked about, and they're also going to send you a bill in the very same letter saying you underreported your income by $75,000, and that gets a person's attention.
Is this called guilty till proven innocent?
That's what it's called.
Okay. I tell the client, I said, listen, this is a one-way street, but we can remove the barrier. We can continue down the street unaffected. But until they get that letter back from the IRS, which could take months, certainly weeks, they're anxious. And then they get it, and it's like, phew. Now, recently, and this is just last week, I haven't seen one of these in years. And what it's called, it's IRS is getting better and better at looking at things. And they sent out a notice and they just want to see the individual's charitable donation support. Now, this wasn't an egregious number that was on there. It wasn't a creative number. It wasn't that they valued their old clothes at three times retail. They valued everything at what they paid. There was no non-cash stuff here. Certainly, they were within the limits of what somebody in that income level would have. And they go, and it's very official. It even looks like an audit. And all they do is want the charitable donation support. The letter that you got from the organization, if you donated, which you would assume you would get, along with the canceled checks or with a credit card. And, you know, the client got unnerved. What's this? And I said, no, it's a fishing expedition, and they're generating statistics. Now, what I found interesting about the form, although the form was dated somewhat recently, the data on which that they had to provide the support was like 12 years ago, the form. You got it there. And it's the last page in that one section. What's the effective date on the last one? It's down the bottom left-hand corner, I think.
August 1999.
Yeah. Yeah, so they're pulling these things out of mothballs, I guess, and maybe they're looking at charitable donations to see that if there's audit material, not for the client, but statistically.
Well, I do know that for taxpayers who live in the local area, there is an ongoing, what the IRS calls a project. And the project is to audit charitable contribution deductions. Now, this many times only applies to people who claim a very large deduction for a donation of property. IRS believes that sometimes when people donate property, a building, a car, something of significant value, they tend to overstate the amount of the deduction. And as a result of that, IRS has initiated a project. But the notice you've given me here is much broader than that. It's looking for the canceled checks and the credit card receipts and the letters from the Salvation Army to say, yes, you did give a box of clothes to us or whatever. That's the first time I've seen one of those.
Yeah, I was surprised, one, with the client, and two, with the detail. The client, straight arrow. Now, on the other hand, I don't know if you remember this. This was probably 15, 20 years ago. The IRS will occasionally look, and I'm not painting the bad picture of the IRS. They're out there to make sure people pay their taxes and fairly, just so that the people that do pay them fairly aren't feel like they're in the minority. And they would go after initially cash basis type small businesses. I'm going to say a hair cuttery. And it wasn't hair cuttery, but I don't want to say barbershop because that's going to date me. But anyway, it's a barbershop or it's a beauty shop or a local sub shop.
Yeah.
And they initially went after that, taxi cab drivers, I remember. But there wasn't a lot of money there to begin with. I think if they hit the jackpot, they got somebody under reporting their income. Then they got creative and they decided to go after attorneys' escrow accounts. I think that's like putting your hand in the hornet's nest.
Yeah.
That didn't last long.
Yeah, the IRS does initiate projects all the time, and I can remember one time when I was in IRS, they had the food vendors project because they concluded that all these people that sell you stuff on the street weren't accurately reporting our income, so they initiated a project. And they found out two things. Number one, these people were not accurately reporting their income. But number two, they also weren't making very much money. So it didn't really result in a lot of collecting unpaid taxes for the IRS.
Yeah. I get this question. It follows in parallel what we're talking about. Well, you know, what can I claim, you know, that I won't be audited? And I said, well, really, that's not the question. It's what can you claim that you paid for? And then somebody that might be, say, very charitable or might have high expenses and they get anxious about possibility of an audit. And as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you have more experience here than I. I've been to them, but you know, the selection process, I really believe it, if it falls outside of some statistical norm for somebody at this income level to have this much in mortgage interest or charitable donations or taxes, then it just kind of doesn't. But if it goes over and blips over, it prints out, but a human doesn't necessarily look at it other than to say, let's have an audit here. Or let's not have one. In other words, if you and I are running this program for the IRS, we're not going to go after somebody where there's maybe $1,000 in question and the taxes are going to be $300. The cost to do it is too high. But if we see something that looks like it's several thousand, $10,000 out of whack with business expenses, then that might be a propensity to be audited.
That's true. IRS, and I used to know a great deal more about how returns were selected for audit. And in the typical way, many people got, well, the most common way was documents matching, where you got $110 in interest income and you transposed a number. You'd get a letter from the IRS. That's not an audit. An audit, to my way of thinking, is when you're called in and asked to prove what you claimed. And many of those returns were selected by computer. And as you said, there are certain norms within which most people fall. And if your level of deductions is way out of whack with what other people of your income level claim, you get a higher DIF score. It's called DIF, D-I-F, Discriminant Index Function. Have no idea what that means, but I know in actuality, the higher your deductions in relation to your income, the greater the likelihood you'll be audited. All it means is if you claim higher than the norm in deductions, it's going to get kicked out and some human is going to look at it and they will conclude whether or not it makes sense for the IRS to audit. That used to be the way many people were selected for audit, but I honestly don't know if that is still the key audit selection procedure.
I don't see too many, if you will, W-2 type audits.
No.
Even if the number's high, even if the number's low, if, like you say, the DIF score is kind of parallel to what the income level is, they go, okay, this makes sense. Or I've seen the audits, and fortunately, it slowed down. But I had a period there for about a year and a half. I had 24 audits or 22 audits. I haven't had 22 audits in my life. But I think what they were doing, they were going out and sampling who was a candidate to go after from a professional standpoint. You know, was it an engineer? Was it an attorney? Was it a clerk? Was it this, that? But then mixed in that were small businesses, and that was the initial wave of it. And they had hired a lot of IRS auditors, and they trained them by going out and auditing these businesses. Now, fortunately, we had what was called a no change. They made no change to the return that was filed, but a lot of angst to the taxpayer. And then there were other ones. Let's say somebody has a small business, and in 2008, 9, and 10, they didn't do as well as prior to that because the economy went down, but their expenses stayed the same. If you're in business, you have to spend, I mean, you're not going to not pay your rent, you're not going to not pay the phone bills, and you have to advertise every bit as much as you did before, if not more, because others might not, and then you get a competitive edge. And I had this one client, won't say what they did, but it was perfectly legal, but it was heavily commissioned, and their expenses were at a certain level, and their expenses were incurred in a general amount. In other words, they would hold gatherings, and they provide finger food and stuff like that. And the auditor says, do you have everybody's name that grabbed a, you know, half a sandwich or a pig in a blanket? And I said, no. He said, we can't deduct it. And I said to the manager, I said, do you ever go to a food court at a mall on the weekend? And he go, yeah, what's that got to do with it? And I said, do they ever offer you a piece of chicken on a toothpick? And he go, yeah. And I said, did you take it? Yeah. And I said, did you give them your name? And they go, well, no. And I said, why don't you go after Chick-fil-A and leave my client alone?
And the result?
I won some concessions.
Yeah.
And eventually, I'd never actually gone to conference before, but I went to conference on this, and they listened more so. And I understand at the audit level why they do what they do. I understand it. But usually there's some give and take. There was none. But I, you know, they didn't hate me for it. They knew I was there to represent the client.
Yeah.
At least I don't think they do. Did. Yeah. Anyway, enough war stories. So, so for those of you that get any of these type of notices, my feeling, this first thing I mentioned, the CP2000, where they just match, are way more wrong than right. Not because the IRS is inefficient, is because something didn't. Column A didn't total column B that had nothing to do with the taxpayer. They didn't get a form, or the form that was sent to the IRS was not right, et cetera.
Yeah, well, sometimes the people issuing the form make mistakes.
Right.
So there are any possibility for errors. And all the IRS computer does is they look on a form, and if the form they got from one person says one and the form they got from the other person says two, they're gonna send out a notice and ask you to explain, which is what many of those notices are. The one thing I do tell most individuals is when you get a letter from the IRS, please don't ignore it. Look at it, read it. If it calls for information, if there's an obvious mistake, tell them that. Call them or write them a letter or whatever, but don't just ignore it.
Yes, well put. We could do war stories there.
Yeah, we certainly could.
But we won't. Now, we got a few minutes, and gee, sure would be nice to get one phone call, 202-465-3080, 202-465-3080. We're coming down, we're not in the final stretch for corporate returns if somebody has a small corporation. That's due next Monday, but we're not going to do corporate. We'll talk about 1040s another month after next week that the 1040s would be due. And people are starting to put their information together now because by now most of the information that should have been received is received regarding the income and the deductions. And they go, what can I do to save taxes? And let's just get to somebody that works for a wage. We'll leave the businesses out of here. And they go, you know, what hidden deductions are there? And as we well know, there are not too many hidden deductions, and I think we have a caller. Do we have a caller, Andrew? Okay, we have a caller. Good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I have a question. My uncle had a home. You know, it's been a family home. You know, my grandmother passed, and it was in disrepair. And a lot of expenses. And so what I did is that we went in on the home with him. You know, I paid to fix it up. I paid to pay, and he gave me half of the interest in the home. We had it for a couple of years, about 4 years, and he got older. We had to sell the home. And so last year we sold it, and I got a 1099-S for half of the sale price, as he did. My uncle got a 1099-S for half of the sale price. I had deductions for the basis, repairs and improvements that I had to do to the property to get it saleable. He'd been in the house for, he'd been in the house for 40 years. It was his residence. My question is that I know I had to claim it as like a gain, kind of like with the 1099 using the basis, but he gets the exemption for his half. Am I correct? I mean, why? I was surprised they issued a 1099-S to him.
I had the exact, you think I'm exaggerating, I had the exact case last week. Individual, lived in the home, like you say, for 40 years, decided that they would maintain a half interest in it, and then they gave it to their three kids the other half. Now, the person, again, was alive during this period of time, and like you say, the house was in disrepair. And they sell it. And each one of the kids got a 1099-S, like you say, for 1/6 of what it sold for. And they go, what's this? And I had talked to them before, but they didn't believe me. And they got this form, and the difference between 1/6 of the sales price, I'm rounding up, and what their, quote, basis in it was, is taxable. And you go, well, there's no basis. They, you know, I got it as a gift. Well, there is a basis, and it's equal to whoever gave it to you's cost in it way back when. And so now, am I paralleling your question?
Well, my question is, I understand there's a basis for me, and I've had to file. I just did my taxes and did everything. My question with him is that he got a 1099, but that was his residence. So I thought there was an exemption
For him.
But he what happened, he filed his 1040 form, and he does a short form, and inadvertently didn't add the 1099. And so the professional that did his taxes says, he brought it after, he says, well, the taxes already went forward. You're probably going to get a notice from the IRS about this 1099, which was about $150,000. My question is, how does he resolve that? He's not supposed to pay taxes on it now, right?
Well, here's what the thinking at the IRS level is, and again, they're not doing this to be nasty. They don't know any better. So you're absolutely right that the exclusion from the gain, if the individual's not married, is $250,000 gain, just wiped out. And you go, well, that's the 150 is a whole lot less than 250. Why are they bothering him? And the answer is, well, what if the basis in that house was close to zero, or they had inherited it, they had been given it by somebody, and it was a whole lot less? Now, I think your point's well taken, though. If the sales price is $150,000, even if the basis is zero, it's not going to be more than $250,000. Mm-hmm. So your point's good there, but the person could have failed the test. In other words, it isn't just a gain, but they had to have lived in that home for any two-year period out of the preceding 5 years. If they had failed that because they were in a nursing home or something like that, there's even an exception for that, there could be a problem. And all you have to do is explain, yeah, it's $150,000, and here's the basis. Thank you, and goodbye.
Right. So we just have to give them documentation when they do contact them.
You got to provide them the documentation. Now, there is no form for the sale of a home, so it goes on an IRS Schedule D as if it was a stock sale. And you show the sales price, and then you show the basis, and you show under a section, it's non-taxable. And I've done that a fair amount.
And that's probably going to what's going to happen, because, like I said, he failed to include it in his taxes. So that program you talked about is probably going to pick up, hey, you got an extra $150,000.
You got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure enough. I believe we have another caller, too. Right, Andrew? Good morning.
Yeah, this is about 1099s. Now, I read something where if it's under $10, let's say a bank, I'll use Bank of America, and I earn interest of $4.96, they don't send me the 1099. I still, enter into one thing that I earned it. What does the IRS do when they say, well, this guy, $4.99, he puts in there, but there's no 1099 for it?
You'd think you'd get a thank you note, but
yeah,
you don't. You can just look him in the eye and say, I always file my return and report the income, even though I didn't get a 1099.
Right.
You will never get a question from the IRS if you over-reported what's on 10, ever.
But here's the other question or a comment. How many people have made under $10 and haven't reported it? Isn't that a lot of money lost by the United States?
You might say more recently because interest rates are so low,
yeah,
but it's nothing that they really want to pursue.
That's what I was getting at, because if it's under a certain amount, under 10, why pursue it?
Right. I mean, that's exactly when Tom and I were talking about the audits. Something spits out of the computer, and if you and I work for the IRS, we're going to go, we're not going to go chase this. It's, it's $100 different or $200 different. The cost to have the auditor look at this for a number of hours and then battle with the taxpayer or their representative, it's just not worth it. So they just kind of go, okay, fine. We'll go after the low-hanging fruit.
Yeah. Well, one quick thing. This is about Washington, D.C. This guy got this bill on his Washington, D.C. taxes that he owed, I think it was $1.59. He pays it, but isn't it kind of petty?
If it didn't, that $1.59, especially in the jurisdiction you mentioned, could rocket to a higher number.
That's what I like about D.C. There's something screwy about this place.
Well, the D.C., I don't know that they're any different than some of the other places, but around here, the other ones seem not to do that.
Yeah.
All righty?
Okay, take it easy, guy.
Thank you.
That's sort of a rule that I apply many times. If you get a bill, you may come to the conclusion, whether they're right or wrong, it's not worth fighting about. Just write them a check and forget about it.
That's right. Actually, I had a client send me an email. I know I'm right, but I'm going to have to fight this. And the individual was an attorney, notably enough, and said, no, it's not worth it. So, all righty. So, Tom, what do we got, 2 minutes? Okay. So some of the deductions and what are we going to do with 1 minute? But we could do it pretty fast. You know, that's a common question. What else can I deduct? Well, it's very hard for a taxpayer. If they're not maximizing their 401k or the TSP, are they going to buy a bigger house to get a larger mortgage deduction? I hope not. Are they going to refinance it and pay the points? You're not going to get them all up front anyway, generally speaking.
Yeah.
Maybe there's child care expenses, maybe not, but we might have taken care of that with a flexible spending account. So what I'm getting at is anything that we can have taken out of the salary up top and be used to pay medical expenses, et cetera, that's the way you want to go.
Yeah. Put max out on the TSP, max out on your flexible spending account. Apart from that, just, you know, our system's geared so that if you have income, you're going to pay tax, and just accept that. There's no magic bullet out there that anybody can tell you that's going to guarantee you don't have to pay any taxes.
Okay, Tom. Well, I thought you were going to give me the magic key to no taxdom.
Well, I certainly can do that. Don't have any income.
Okay.
That's the key to not paying any taxes.
All righty. Or if I don't pay taxes, I'll be in a place where I don't make any money.
That's true.
All righty. Final comments, Tom?
Well, the only thing I would encourage people to do is if you can't get your tax return done on time, request an extension. There are hefty penalties for failure to file and failure pay, but at least request the extension.
Very simple to do. Good advice. Thanks, Tom. Thanks for being here. And thank you all for listening. And we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.